Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm joined by Juliet Stevenson, who's about to return to the Young Vic to play Winnie in Beckett's Happy Days, a role for which won her enormous acclaim last spring. She'd already performed in other Beckett works before that, Footfalls and Not I in 1997, directed by Katie Mitchell, and Play, which she recorded for the Beckett on Film season in 2001. She's well known for a body of other theatre work, including Shakespeare, Ibsen, Chekhov, and Ariel Dorfman's Death and the Maiden, for which she won an Olivier. Her films include Bend It Like Beckham and Truly Madly Deeply, for which she was nominated for a BAFTA. And there have been acclaimed roles in TV series too, such as The Politician's Wife and Accused, and a good deal of radio. Well, thank you very much for finding time in your busy schedule to fit in this interview. Let's begin with the demands of this part. It's the physical and mental demands. You begin buried up to your waist, and by the second act are buried up to your neck in Scree. And before you begin, there's an enormous learning task to do. Do you enjoy it?
Well, to my amazement, I came to enjoy it hugely, although probably the word enjoy is slightly misleading. In fact, there's probably not a single verb for describing the experience. You'd have to sort of combine verbs to cover the ground, because I did enjoy it hugely, but that was never without finding it an enormous challenge. I mean, every night at 7:30, you stand at the foot of a mountain and look up. And in the way that anybody who's done that, having to climb it, knows that there is a mixture of apprehension and exhilaration in the knowledge that you may or may not make it to the top of that mountain. It's the same. You think, will I get through this tonight? Will I remember it all? Will I in any way match up to its demands? And but that is also what I love. I do love quite extreme challenges, and as well as being fearful of them, and perhaps because of being fearful of them. So I think It suits me quite well, in the sense that I do love difficulty, and somewhere I must have some sense of confidence that I can do it. But that doesn't mean that nightly I'm not in awe of what lies ahead. And for many reasons, largely, I suppose, because of the physical and mental challenge. Weirdly, although I'm stuck, as you say, in supposed sand in the first half and up to my neck in the second, it feels like the most physical play I've ever done. It feels immensely physical. And when I come off, every muscle is exhausted and I'm running in sweat, as though I had run a marathon. It's a really weird thing. Partly because in the first half, what we explored, and I really enjoyed this discovery, was that she is somebody who makes the most of absolutely every tiny thing. She makes the most. She's a glass half full person. So I decided that if she was going to be buried up to her waist, she would make the maximum use of the unburied half. So I never relax up there. She's always trying to maintain her sense of dignity and femininity and
almost
class.
Like a ballet dancer.
Like a dancer. Mm. So her arms are always lifted. She's always lifted. She never slumps in her hole. And if she does slump, you know, I always realise that she does slump only when she is on the verge of giving up. And Beckett very clearly gives her moments when she does nearly give up. And then she inhales some more oxygen and, you know, kicks off again with some scraped optimism. And so there's that. There is a physical challenge. There's also, I mean, the mental challenge of learning. And not just learning. There are many mental challenges. Learning it was massively difficult.
Yes, and it's almost a monologue, not quite.
It's almost a monologue. So you have the double difficulty of not being able to rely on other people coming in to ask you things or say things to you, which serve as a cue. Yes. You know, a lot of the way we remember plays is because somebody comes in and says, what time are we leaving, darling? And you say, oh, that's my cue for saying, oh, I think after lunch, don't you? You know, but of course, there's nobody very rarely saying anything. And when David Beams, who plays Willie, does come on. Yeah, I have a physical sense of relief when he starts joining in about 15 minutes into the play. You think, oh, thank goodness David's here. Because it is very much a duologue.
In fact, because she does need him to be there.
The biggest discovery of all that I made was that it's not a monologue. I think it's, well, that we made, Natalie and I.
This is Natalie Abrahami, who's the director.
The very wonderful Natalie. is that it's not a monologue. And I think that's sometimes been a mistake that people make, thinking it's this huge one-woman show. It really, really isn't. He's there all the time. And even when I say, you know, I refer to him as entering, he doesn't enter. He is sleeping from the start. He wakes up 15 minutes in, but he's always there. And from the start, she's talking to him. She says many, many times during the play, the most terrifying thing she can think of is that she is alone talking to herself. Yeah. That is her ultimate, you know, that's her room 101. That's her ultimate horror. So therefore, she's not talking to herself. And even when she thinks he's dead in the second half, she says, but I can't be talking to myself, ergo, you're alive. You know?
Yeah. So it's and if you're dead, you're still there anyway.
And if you're dead, you're still there anyway. Yeah. So she, which makes it transitive, which means that she's always talking to him, for him. She's got someone to pitch all her responses, her feelings, her thoughts to. And she, it makes her know that she's not mad, which is her greatest terror of being a gabbling head in the sand. And it also makes her, you know, her sense of being desperately alone. It appeases that. So there's all sorts of reasons. And it helps the actress, in this case me, enormously, because you are then playing everything with someone else. You know who you're talking to. It solves an enormous number of problems, and it also means that on all the thousands of occasions when he doesn't reply or doesn't give her what she's asking for, there's all sorts of richness there to play, you know, of what you do when somebody's persistently ignoring you and habitually has ignored you for many years. You know, it's the most amazing portrait of a marriage, which is very often about that, you know, yes. Kinds of silence, kinds of non-communication, that marriages become built around.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that Beckett gives you an indication. He gives you lots of indications. In fact, so many that when you're reading the script, most of it, at least half of it, is stage direction, isn't it? Telling you exactly what the actress is supposed to be doing at every second. Did you find that claustrophobic or helpful or what? Even, you know, smile switches on, smile switches off.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastically challenging. Mm-hmm. So when I was approaching the first rehearsal period last year, I decided for the first time in my working life of 35 years that I better start learning it before rehearsal started. I have had a rule never to do that because I like to start rehearsal, even if you've only got a short amount of time. I like to start rehearsal not having learnt it so that there's some sense of openness with the other actors. There's something about learning it before you start that makes me feel you're closing things off. And since my great joy and my belief in theatre is that, you know, we affect each other, it's the play exists between the actors, not inside them. You know, it's all interactive. It's a collaboration. And so I've always thought one should not learn lines or close anything off before you. But on this occasion, I realised I would have to start learning the lines before rehearsals because otherwise we wouldn't use the time valuably. I'd be spending the whole time trying to learn it. And so I learned about half, which took weeks and weeks and weeks before rehearsal started. And then I had to learn the rest as we went along. And what was I saying? I've lost track now.
You were talking about the stage directions and whether
That's right. And the stage directions. So you've got to learn the text, which is massive, but you've also got to learn as many, you know, stage directions. And the amount of times we went over and over and over, and I mean hundreds and hundreds of times trying to remember the first 20 minutes is extremely complicated because of the order in which she takes objects out. He has her take an object out on the second half of a word, you know, unscrewing her lipstick on a given tiny little, you know, indefinite article or something. I mean, he is so precise. And I wanted to start by being as precise as possible and then later on we could see if we could free it up. But we didn't decide to be free with it to start with. And I think that's very much my tendency with writers, is if they're a good writer, let alone a great one, then I like to think that that's the map. That's the map. You don't scratch out the route of the M1 and make it go in a different direction because you want to get somewhere quicker. You have to go up the M1 and then you have to take the by road of, you know, the B432. You follow the map as it is on the you don't create your own rules, and I love that because I think through discipline you achieve much greater kinds of creative freedom. So we did. I was absolutely scrupulous for a long time, and then every moment where he says she has a defiance being Beckett's word for when she has an internal collapse, when the hope runs out, from which she then lifts herself up. And he has many different degrees of that, so it can be a slight one, a slightly bigger one, a very big one. And they are graded, you know, degrees of breakdown. You could even, you know, number them. In fact, we did. Is this a one or a five? You know, but they're all wonderfully, you know, the more you know the play, the more you understand how accurate he was with all those specific, very minutely specific directions. But having said all that, the most liberating moment was round about the third or fourth preview when Natalie Abrahami said to me, OK, I've got one note for you tonight. And I said, what's that? And she said something I can't probably repeat, but she said, it translates as, to hell with Beckett. To hell with him. You know, fuck Beckett is what she said. And I said, Natalie. You know, she said, no, what I mean is, you know, we've done the work now. We've done that incredible, you know, you've done the scales and arpeggios relentlessly. So now forget them. And... So that's my joy, really, when you've done that groundwork on the discipline of exactly the rhythms and the shapes that he has given you. And then you can say, well, I don't know. I don't know about this one. I think I can. But I have to say that almost always Beckett's right. Yes. He's almost always right. And even when I get a tiny syllable wrong, if I say the instead of a, or if I say however instead of but, there's something in the paraphrase, which is just slightly less good, less accurate. And when you find that the word is actually but rather than however, you think, oh, of course. And the rhythm of the line tells you something more profound or funnier, or it's just better. So every time, you know, you are slightly inaccurate and you come back to the accurate version, you get a reward.
Well, in rehearsals, did you talk about, is there any point in having a backstory with Beckett? I mean, did you talk about how you'd got there, what has happened? Because he wants it to be vague, doesn't he? He actually took out a line about a bomb, I think, didn't he? The indicating there might have been a nuclear holocaust or something.
Oh, I don't know about the bomb. Natalie Abrahami, one of the many wonderful things about her as a director is that she does incredible amount of fantastic homework. So she'd been to Reading, where the archives are. She had versions of every draft of the play. And the beautiful thing about the days before screens is that when people deleted, you know, you could see it. Yes. So you got these versions where he's literally crossed things out and written them again. And so you can see the way his mind was working. And yes, he starts off, his earlier drafts were more specific. They were more located in Ireland. And then they were much more specifics. And he vaguened it. Vagan is his own verb. It's a word he made up, you know, to make vague. And that's the general tendency of his ensuing drafts of the play. But in fact, there's still loads left there. And if you do what I love to do, which is to pick out every little reference to the past, every single one, and put them in a pool, you've got loads of information. And in fact, we spent quite a lot of time in rehearsal making backstories and improvising.
About their relationship?
Yes, exactly. Mm. Their relationship, her circumstances, his, how they came to meet, how they came together, why they married, what were the forces, the expectations of them both separately and together, and then what started to change and how they might have ended up in the place they are.
And did you come to any conclusions about what has happened to make her buried up to her waist and him not doing anything about it, apparently? Or can he not do anything about it? He doesn't help her.
Well, he has withdrawn into his morass of incapacitating privateness and depression. He is, you know, I mean, I couldn't now sort of write a biography of this couple, but I think the reasons why they've got to where they've got, which is in this sort of utterly separated, lonely place whereby they have a very huge dependency on each other, but neither is meeting the other's needs, which is the most extraordinary place to be. We're utterly dependent on each other, can't live without each other, but neither's needs is being met by the other at all, so they're having to live and find what they need just to survive from separate sources. In her case, just her mind, her mind, her capacity to use language, to retain everything that seems important to her, her identity, her dignity, her any joy that she can salvage from her experience, her view of the world, her understanding of what has happened, her everything, even her sexuality in some way. I mean, everything relies on her. And yet she has to know at least that he is hearing her. As for him, you know, it's a state in which many marriages exist, but it's just taken to this graphic extreme.
So it's a sort of a metaphor.
It's a metaphor, but you know, we talked a lot about well, if it's a metaphor, then you know, how does she go to the loo? How does she drink? How does she, you know, how is that happening? And if he describes her as looking worse in the second half, looking battered, well then. Why are we making that decision when in the first half she looks okay? You know, she isn't scorched black by the sun. Her hair hasn't fallen out with dehydration. I mean, so we're presenting her with an image in the first half of a very unnatural sort of a symbolic image of somebody who looks rather good, like a suburban housewife who goes to the hairdresser once a week. And in the second half, she is wrecked and battered by the physical circumstances of her situation. But that's, you know, that's what he wanted. He did want her to look good in the first half from the waist up and have deteriorated a lot in the second half. So, in a sense, it's we play it as a metaphor in the first half and take it a little bit more literally in the second.
Yeah. And she of course, has the gun, which is amongst all her very ordinary objects in her bag, because he might commit suicide if he gets it. And she trying to...
Interesting that you should say that, very.
Ah, right.
Because, yes, that is the reference to it.
Yes.
But, of course, in my head...
She might use it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Or he might use it against her.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes, of
All
course.
We know is that the gun is something that he used to say, you know, take it away, before I put myself out of my misery. Which is a pretty terrible thing for a husband to say to a wife, you know.
Yes.
The only thing that's keeping me alive and not from killing myself, living with you, is that you hide the gun. hide the gun from me, you know. But yeah, that's the third person. The gun, in a way, is the third person in the relationship, I feel.
And at the end, in this production, well, there's a chance that they may possibly find a way out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think he intends that ambiguity, Beckett. Mm. I mean, he's pulling himself up the slope towards her, and we know that the gun is lying beside her. She can't touch it because she has no hands. I mean, she's, you know, buried up to the neck, but he can. And if he gets up level with it, what might he do? Might he blow her brains out, or his own, or...
And he's really struggling to get there, isn't he?
Yes, but you know, she keeps saying, what is it you want, Willie? Is it a kiss? Is it a kiss? Or something else? You know, she doesn't know whether he's coming to claim her or to claim the gun. It's brilliant. No, I mean, what's so brilliant is that it's partly a thriller, as just described. It's incredibly funny, you know. I mean, the great discovery is, of course, when is Beckett not funny? It's so funny. In their misery, there is so much wit, and I never realised that before I started. And it's heaven to play on a good night, you know, because audiences are really, really laughing with recognition. She says some hilarious things about marriage, and anybody who's been in any kind of relationship just can't help. You know, it's very, very witty. And most of his work is. So I think that the more, you know, there's so much to be said. I mean, the more human you make these, the more backstories you explore and create, the more real it is, the infinitely more the audience get out of it. And the idea that Beckett always insisted that, you know, that nobody ever interrogates the text, they never ask realistic or human questions of it, he doesn't want to explore any psychology ever, you know, all these things we know that Beckett said to his actresses. Nonsense. I mean, you know, like many writers, he's not the best director. Why should he be? He had a genius capacity to write. He wasn't necessarily gifted with the same capacity to direct. And many writers don't direct their own work brilliantly. Doesn't make them any less great writers. But there are very few writers who direct their work well, in fact. So, you know, I kept on saying to Natalie, let us revere him as a writer entirely. Let us not revere him as a director. Because I simply don't agree with him. I don't agree with him. You know, you don't interrogate... And you just made his actresses sing it all.
Yes. Well, a writer lets his work free in the theatre for others to put there.
Exactly. For a reason, exactly. There is another contribution. You can write a play, and then there's a whole other creative process that happens before you give it to an audience, and that's the one where the writer
Although
may
he
need...
does seem to be controlling it as well as possible by telling you what to do every half second.
Yes, he is, but in a way that's like a great... that's like in the way that Bach is, or Beethoven is, you know, giving you very strict sort of hoops to jump through and making huge demands of his players, his musicians, but knowing that, of course, they will be in making their own interpretation.
Yeah.
And I think that's... I always thought the musical score, the composer, was a great analogy with Beckett, because I have never come across anything that is so like a musical score. You know, it is like a massive virtuosic work for an instrument, for a solo instrument or something with another instrument there, of course, but... And it's all the same rules, you know. You have to observe minutely the musical notation, but in the end, you know, one pianist is going to differ from another. One great violinist will differ from another. You're free to make enormous numbers of choices and still be extremely loyal to that score. Mm. And I say score because rhythms are so crucial. It is like music in that sense. Mm. You mustn't sing it, because thereby you'll make it sort of poetic and not real, and that would be horrendous. Mm. But the rhythms of it are incredibly elucidating and revelatory about the psyche of the characters. So if you adhere to his amazing rhythms to the last comma and full stop, and, you know, is it a dot, 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 or is it a dot, dot, or is it a dash, or, you know, all these things mean stuff, and you have to observe them. And once those rhythms are in your system... You will travel far deeper into the character psychology than you otherwise would, because in that rhythm is the meaning.
She, as it were, represents the whole of humanity, doesn't she? But it's also, she's also a person, and she is also, very importantly, a woman. I mean, it's, and she's very womanly.
Yes.
And all her everyday bits and pieces and things are all to do with keeping up appearances and being...
They are mostly, yes.
Mostly,
they are.
Yes.
There's the gun and there's medicine. Yes. But you could say that that's for her appearance too.
But there's also prayer and music, and, you know, it's as if, you know, a religion and the arts also help the human get through, perhaps. Or is religion only just part of her?
Well,
part of her routine.
I think you can make any number of decisions about that. But what Beckett tells you, the facts that we have, or the clues, is that at the beginning of the play, the first thing she does when she wakes up, pretty much, is to pray.
Yeah.
She prays once, and then she puts her hands down, and then she thinks, for some reason, she takes them back up again and clasps them again and prays a second time, and we never hear the prayer. It's the only time Beckett has her muttering something that we don't know what it is, so I make up my own until the end, and then you get the last, you know, world without end, amen. Or it seems to be fairly perfunctory, but it's part of her routine, and routine is everything for Winnie, because that's the structure. There is no night, no day, there are no hours or minutes, there's nothing to break up the passage of time. It is unbroken. There are no seasons. I mean, it's unimaginable. But she has to make her own structure, and the bell is the only structure. And at the end of the first half, after that whole journey she's been through, she tries to pray and can't. And it seems pretty clear to me. And at the moment of not being able to, the first half ends in our production with a landslide, because in the second half she's now buried up to her neck.
So more stuff has
come to bury her. And I think that her loss of faith, her not believing in prayer, is one of the things that's burying her. She can't... it's a huge piece of hope that she's had to give away. So that's religion. Music...
Is the music box.
Is the music box, yeah. Which... I always thought was a symbol of her childhood, when it was given to her, perhaps by her mama, by her mum, and it plays...
Yeah, she's much posher than he is. Her mama, you said.
Yes.
He's a brute, isn't he? She's described as.
Well, I mean, not to say there aren't a lot of posh brutes. I mean,
yes, that's true. But, I mean, lots of snot and hawking and all that. And
Yeah, he has become. I mean, we did, interesting you should say it, because we did decide in the Mac stories that she has married sort of, inverted commas, below her social class, and that's partly why she got cut off from her family. And yes, song matters to her a lot. It's one of the things she does. And you know, the music box plays the song from The Merry Widow, which we also know is what they danced to or sang together in happier days. Mm. So that musical box represents the happiness lost, I think, in some ways, a happier time. And she clutches it and brings it out of the bag at the biggest of her defiances, at the most extreme slump in the first half, when she is completely slumped over the whole. Beckett has her completely, you know, her elastic has snapped, and she's slumped right over herself, and one arm comes out and pulls the musical box out of the bag. She just has the energy to turn it on, you know, and then listening to it gives her enough energy to sort of lift herself back up again and go on. But so it's obviously, therefore, we can tell it's an object of enormous significance for her, solace, some source of strength.
Well, there is a hint of another world of some sort around these people, because the bell is coming from somewhere.
Mm.
And they also see a couple going past, or she does.
She did.
She did.
In the past.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. They haven't come for a while.
No. But they were able to walk about, as far as we can tell.
They did. They did, with their luggage. They come with bags, hand in hand. And Mr. and Mrs.
Shower.
Yes, Mr. and Mrs. Shower, which we talked endlessly about. In fact, I never, even in performance, decided exactly what that relationship was. I mean, I had great fun in performance exploring different things. I even at one point used to play my toothbrush and toothpaste that's lying in front of her. You know, they were the characters of Mr. and Mrs. Shower. And, you know, like a child would pick up things and make them into people. All her objects in her bag are like people. They're like her friends. You know, she hasn't got anybody else. Her bag is her best friend. Mm. But her best friend, her bag, contains these other little characters in it. And she talks to them. You know, she talks to them and at them.
Mm.
I'm going to put you down there. And, you know, that serves you right. You know, she says, you know, to the gun, and it's so sweet the way she talks to her toothbrush and her comb. And we all know, you know, that. Well, I do anyway. And and so, yeah, the shower cookers are the last human beings that she has laid eyes on. And of course, you know, we know from both versions, because when she brings them back in the second half and tells the same story, but slightly differently. The facts seem the same, but the nature of the characters has got coarser, and what he says to her and about her is coarser. So we feel that in the first half she's doing what she always does, which is to sort of dress it up a bit and make it slightly more.
Mm.
But, you know, he treats her simply like the most sort of brutal sexual object. He's only interested in, you know, what's... So there was any number of attitudes towards that. Or, of course, she might be talking about them themselves. She might be, that might never have happened, and she might be just describing her version of Winnie and Willie.
Yes.
And using anecdote, as we often do, to tell a story, as in therapy. You know, she calls them by different names, but they are them.
Yeah.
Possibly.
People always say when they do a long run that things change a lot during it. I mean, did it change much for you?
Oh, beyond measure. I mean, one of the many, many wonderful things about being asked to do this is that, you know, that's what I like to do when I'm in a play, is I like to keep working at it. And if it's a halfway good play, you can do that.
Mm.
And with, you know, Shakespeare play or Chekhov or, you know, any good contemporary playwright, you can go on and on and on finding more in the play over a long run. And that's what keeps you alive. Well, with this, there just isn't ever any end to what you can find. So I think now, by the end of an 8-week run, what I was doing up there bore little relation to what I did on the first preview. You know, I learnt so much in the run. I developed so many things. I found so much shape in it. I mean, inevitably, I'm not saying that. It sounds a bit braggy. I don't mean that. I just mean that, you know, just how little I had found out even by the end of a very happy and constructive rehearsal period. We learnt, because Natalie came a lot, you know, I think we learnt as much, if not much more, in that run of the play than we had by the time we opened it. And the reason I wanted to come back and do another run was that I felt there was still masses still to do, to find, to discover. And I couldn't bear to stop.
I was going to ask you what it felt like coming back to it. I mean, presumably it's all still in your head.
I don't know what's in my head. I mean, Natalie and I have met we've tried to meet once every 6 weeks or so, what we call Beckett in the bottom oven, just sort of simmering it, keep it warm, because the thought of having to learn it again from scratch is terrible. And it seems a really bad idea to let it all go. So we've been meeting when we could and having a go at it, just to see how much I can remember and try and retain it. And that's not always been easy, because actually I was working very hard last year, solidly, and so was she. So it wasn't always possible. And then when we did meet, I would have forgotten a lot normally. But it's been a fascinating exercise in the nature of memory. Because what I remember, if I don't remember the actual words, is I often do remember the rhythm or the action of the next line. So I say something and then I can't remember what she says next, but I do remember that what she says next is to cancel out what she just said or to contradict it. And that memory is very clear and strong. How she says that, I'm not quite sure. And that's been fascinating, that we remember the thought pattern beneath the word pattern. And I remember the rhythm even below that. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
It's really interesting. And it's been fascinating in just how memory works. Yeah. And Natalie always says, don't prepare for the next, don't look at it. And I never have. I turn up without the text. And we just see what's there. It's been really interesting. But I am aware that next week I start rehearsals and we haven't got very long. And I have no idea how much is going to be there.
Had you ever seen anyone else play it? Some very great people have played it as well before you.
Only twice. I saw Peggy Ashcroft do it. When I was a drama student, when I was about 18, at RADA. We were taken to see her at the National, but I didn't like it. You know, I admired Peggy Ashcroft very much, but I really didn't like it. I remember being bored. I think I went to sleep even. And I don't mean to be disrespectful. I think I was very young. I think that, you know, I didn't come to Beckett until I was much older. It didn't mean anything to me. The more life I lived, the more I understood him. And then I saw Fiona Shaw do it about 7 years ago, I think, at the National.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yes, another one at the National, that's right.
Yeah. Again, at the National. Yes.
Quite often it's played Irish, isn't it? Did you make a distinct decision not to do that?
Well, I assumed it would have to be Irish. It was Natalie who insisted not. And this is a tricky one, because when you do play her Irish, a lot of the rhythms of the writing, of course, naturally, Beckett being Irish, they seem to serve the rhythms of the text. But then there are some real anomalies, like she uses the third person singular very often to describe herself. She says, she uses the word one. One does not do this, or one likes to think, or one, you know, which is a very posh English thing. You don't hear the Irish talking about one went to the theatre and one saw a great play, or one eats one's breakfast. And, you know, they don't use that word. And so there's no conclusive sort of proof that you should go in either direction. It was very much Natalie who said, I don't want you to play this with an Irish accent. And I was quite resistant to start with, but I came to think that she was absolutely right, in fact. And I don't think you need to. And, you know, I really don't think you need to. I think that he is not. I mean, he took out, one of his ways of vagueing the play was that he took out every direct reference to Ireland. And I think there's only one place name left, which is sort of ambiguously somewhere in outside Dublin. But otherwise, he took out all the sort of local and specific references, and I think he wanted it to be universal. And that seems right to me. The problem with English is that any English accent contains messages about class and you don't really want to pin her down in England either, except that she is very aspirational, that we do know. And so if she has a slightly, you know, suburban, posh English accent, that felt sort of right. Because she definitely was a creature of the suburbs. You know, she's an unremarkable woman in a remarkable situation.
Well, you're in a remarkable situation again, aren't you? Going to do the Winnie at the Young Vic. Thank you very much, Juliet. It was lovely talking to you.
A pleasure.